episode of Pit Lane Parlay.
Welcome to another episode of Pit Lane Parlay. My name is host Mike Jokum. Jess and Matt both joined me tonight. Guys, how are we doing after a crazy Detroit weekend?
Good.
I'm kind of sleepy.
Yeah, you and me both. After many weeks on the road, I'm looking forward to sitting out Texas and watching it on my couch. But before we get there, plenty to talk about with Texas. So let's dive right into it. And I'll turn it over to Matt to bring up the first topic of the duel in Detroit.
Yeah, two races, always a good time there. Got to dive into Detroit's one and two, so plenty to talk about, plenty to recap. There was a bunch of stuff that happened in both races that are worth discussing here, so we'll just get right to it. Detroit won. The top five was Joseph Newgarden, followed by Alexander Rossi, Sato, Rosenquist, and Hunter Rey. So definitely a good showing from Newgarden and Rossi specifically. They really broke away from the field there at the end, and Newgarden definitely caught a timely yellow to leapfrog Rossi, so good on Tim Cindric on that call. There was a tornado warning that delayed the race, so Mike and I hid in the media center, kind of hit it and waited it out, and the race was delayed, and then it was decided that the race was going to be a timed 75-minute race. The goal there was to try to keep it on NBC as much as possible, but then unfortunately they did have to switch to CNBC anyways. So Jess, I just kind of wanted to get your opinion on, first of all, what your thoughts were about the timed race, and then the second of all, about the NBC-CNBC swap that they did.
So I would be curious to know if they knew when they started they were going to have to switch to CNBC, you know, at the end anyways, because if they knew that in advance, why make it timed? If they didn't know that in advance and they were trying to keep it in the NBC window, then I could kind of see it happening. But I'm going to be honest, I had no idea what was going on. They switched it over, and I could never find it. I ended up having to watch the end on Gold, so I wasn't very pleased with it, but I'm sure that it was for a reason.
Yeah, my only gripe is I wish it was a 90-minute timed race if they knew they were going to need to make the swap to CNBC, but you know, at the track, I think the weather kind of cut. I don't want to say caught everybody by surprise because we knew there was a chance of rain, but with the tornado warning and the lightning, which I think was a little bit of a surprise, maybe, you know, they weren't, you know, fully prepared to be able to run a 90-minute timed race on, you know, either network or whatever. But it was a little bit of a bummer when, you know, with the wackiness that was, you know, Scott Dixon going into the wall, that we only had 37 minutes of green flag running and 37 minutes and change of yellow flag running. So that was definitely a little bit of a disappointment to me.
Yeah. You know, whoever's decision it was to definitely delay the race, obviously it was a good call just to make sure fans and everybody at the track was safe. But then, yeah, like you guys said, I would like to know kind of what went into that decision to make it a 75-minute timed race. As I explained to Mike and a couple others at the time, you know, I thought it would be up to just sunlight, basically. So as long as the sun was out, it'd be good to go. You know, not really thinking about the TV side of it. And so when they announced 75 minutes, I was a little confused. Wasn't the best situation, in my opinion. But they also, like, you know, this wasn't something they planned for, obviously, with a tornado warning. So they kind of made the best they could with a bad situation, but I don't think they executed it as well as they could have. But that's, I guess, neither here nor there, if I could speak. Yeah, but overall, the race itself was pretty good. Mike, as far as driver and disappointment of the day, who is the best and worst, in your opinion, from race one?
Man, race one, I think I'm going to go Rossi. He seemed to have a fantastic car. And if not for, you know, a spectacular strategy call by Tim Cindric and Newgarden, you know, getting in, what was that, a lap before the yellow flag, I think that Rossi wins the race. And disappointment of the day for race one, how do you not pick Scott Dixon here? I know that might be low-hanging fruit, but he made his first mistake in 5 years and just put it into the wall with nobody really around him. So those are my picks.
Why did you pick him? God. okay, so for my driver of the day, I'm going to go with Sato. He was at the end trying to make some moves, even in the wet lines, that I thought were pretty impressive. Obviously, they didn't all pan out for him, but he did end up on the podium, and I thought he did really well. Man, disappointment of the day. I'm going to have to go with Tony Kanaan. And I commented on this online, I think. I can't remember for sure. But when that kerfluffle happened there at the beginning, he hit the curb fine, and then he accelerated right into the pack of cars that was wrecked in front of him. So I was a little frustrated with what was he thinking, because frankly, from the replays that I've watched, it looked like if he would have not accelerated, he probably would have been able to save his race, but he did, and well, he wound up in the melee. So I'm gonna say he was it.
That was race two. Did you
have it was?
Yeah, did you have a race one?
I'm sorry. Okay. I thought that was in race
no one. Yeah, that's all good. That was a race two in Pagano / Power /
yeah, when they all, I'm sorry, I thought that was in race one.
That's all good.
I'm getting them all confused now.
It's tough one weekend.
You're just going to do both years at the same time. It's going to be double the fun here.
Okay, well then, oh crap. let me see here. For race one, oh crap, now I'm getting them both confused. Ed Jones kind of just buried it in there himself, didn't he?
Yeah, that was mine. Dang it.
Sorry. I was like, wait, was that in race two too?
No. Yeah, he definitely made a hash of that in race one.
Yeah, he just overshot it and obviously got in the wet, and then it was all over for him. Yeah, so I guess I'll go with him.
Yeah, so mine, my race one, the candidate I had for disappointment of the day actually turned out to be my driver of the day, and that was actually Zach Veach. A very good comeback to P8 after spinning and going to the rear of the field on the warm-up laps. Would have actually had a better position if the race control pit closure thing never happened, and we'll discuss that here in a second. But yeah, overall, to just finish 8th, I thought that was a really good race for him. And then disappointment, at no fault of his own, Willpower, with the pit stop error that, you know, the wheel fell off as he exited the pits, you know, no fault of Powers, but he was having a really good race, was charging through the field, and then to kind of get shuffled to the back. Yeah. Unfortunately that was a bummer to see, cause I thought he was going to have a really good result there. But Mike, as I had just touched on with the, you know, Veach not getting optimal pit situation, as did Hunter Ray, Andretti, Ferrucci, and there was one other guy, I believe, who pitted kind of early in the window.
Ferrucci,
basically, can you imagine it? Maybe. Basically, what happened, if anybody didn't see it at home, was normally when a yellow flag comes out, they allow the field to bunch up. And so when the cars that haven't pitted do pit, the cars that did already pit before the yellow flag came out get to jump to the top of the field. However, in this situation, drivers like Marco and Veach and Hunter Ray were not caught up to the rear of the field. So by the time the drivers had pitted and come out, they were still ahead of those three Andretti Autosport drivers. And that did catch the rage of the drivers themselves and Michael Andretti and Brian Herta after the race. So, Mike, what do you make of that whole situation?
And you feel for Marco and everybody who got caught up in that, because – I think you know, you and I both looked at each other and went, "Oh my God, Marco's about to be in first place." But I understand that race control was trying to, you know, kind of hurry up and get everybody going green instead of, you know, closing the pits for another lap. And, you know, this could have been averted if they went to a 90-minute race. So I'm not all that thrilled with how they handled it, but I think it could have been avoided altogether and we wouldn't have, even had to have this discussion.
So before I jump in with exactly how I feel about it, do you guys think that they did what they did because of the issue at the end of the 500 after the red flag?
Actually, I was just thinking that as Mike was talking, I'm thinking, you know, it's people like us who probably caused this because we were sitting here one week ago on our soapboxes.
Everybody complained about the, what was it, 7 or 8 laps of yellow to reshuffle the field. Well, they didn't do it. And I mean, you know, I like, correct me if I'm wrong, but this is the kind of a newer thing that they started a few years ago. They didn't used to do that. Where you were is where you were. And you know, you had to fight through all the lap traffic and everything else. But to say that race control screwed this up, I wouldn't go that far. But if they didn't kind of pre-warn teams that this is what was going to happen because of the timed race or because they were trying to avoid the controversy of the 7 yellow laps for no apparent reason, it's kind of, I do kind of feel for the drivers who got caught out, but it's one of those racing things, I think.
Yeah, I mean, there's no way around it. I think race control got it wrong. And I can sit here and make excuses for them all day long. But, I mean, it happens. It's just one of those things that's just going to happen every now and then. They're not going to get every call right. They're not going to get everything right. I don't know if they just missed the fact that the cars that had pitted weren't gapped up to the field yet. I know they came up with an explanation that's kind of escaping me at the moment. But, you know, it happens. There's no point in dwelling on it. If you're a driver, you kind of just got to put your head down and get to the next race. And before we get to the next race, just one quick thing to comment on is that, you know, we're not the biggest Marco Andretti fans on this podcast, but how about that lap where he basically came in about 2 to 3 laps too early for dry tires with the track drying. But when he went back out, it was still pretty damp. And the video of his onboard went viral of him hustling the car around the track. Either of you guys, did you guys think that was pretty cool at all?
I thought it was extremely impressive.
Considering I said to whoever was standing next to me at the time, he's going to put it in the wall, and he managed to not put it in the wall and, you know, continue on. Mega, mega, mega impressive.
I think that was with my new best friend, Holly, that you were talking to. So,
I mean, Polly, DJ Polly Ramsey.
Oh, yeah. Sorry, Polly. Running joke. What was it? She went to Starbucks and they wrote Polly on her cup instead of Holly. Unfortunately, that never happens with Hickey. So, we're good there. Do they mess up Mike ever?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Mika.
No, one time.
Oh, man. Jess, do you have any Starbucks stories where they mess up Jess or Jessica?
I can't say that I do, no.
Never Holly to Polly. Yeah, that's pretty bad. Anyways, but moving on to race 2, which I think we can all agree was a better quote-unquote race.
Yes.
Or as Scott Dixon described in the press conference, much more like you would have found in 2012, 13, or 14, just a lot of random stuff happened and a lot of reshuffling of the field happened and the Firestone Reds kind of threw a curveball in there, which we'll discuss here in a second. But anyways, the top 5 for Detroit race 2 was Dixon, followed by Erickson, Power, Hunter Ray, and Rossi. Right away, we'll just start with one of the crazier instances of the race, which was coming into turn 3. Newgarden was attempting to get around James Hinchcliffe, who was just coming out of the pits, with Alexander Rossi right behind him, who was also trying to get around Newgarden and Hinch. And so going into the turn, Newgarden broke really late and then at the exit of the corner spun it on his own and actually backed up into Hinch and collected him. Rossi did spin and just turned it around and kept going on his own while Hinch and Newgarden had to be rescued and or sent back to the pits for repairs. Jess, what was your whole viewpoint of that whole incident?
Yeah, Newgarden was trying for a miracle there, and I think he could have given it another half a lap or so. I think he effectively just ruined three of their days for basically no reason whatsoever, because obviously Rossi was on cold tires. He did have an advantage, and like I said, he could have just waited until he had a little bit better opportunity to do that.
Yeah, I can't argue there. As soon as it happened, it reminded me of Newgarden at the Indy GP last year when he got a little too aggressive with Sebastian Bourdais when he could have just waited to, you know, till the next straightaway. So, yeah, he ruined Hinch's day. Rossi was able to at least somewhat recover to finish fifth or sixth. So, not unfortunate over aggressive move by Newgarden there.
And before we get to kind of the rest of the race storylines here, we'll talk about Will Power's comeback. Will Power, I think it was right after the first lap accident, actually, so like a couple laps after that, and had a gearbox issue that led to like an electrical issue. I don't know if the electrical issue caused everything, but basically his car stopped on track, and you know, we're sitting in Will Power's pits thinking, all right, race is over, he's done. They actually got him fired up before the pace car passed him, so he stayed on the lead lap. Apparently whatever was wrong with the car fixed itself and then was still behind the field. It wasn't gapped up, kind of like race one. He wasn't towards the back of the pack yet, but they threw the green flag and he caught a yellow, so then he got to get to the back and basically ended up somehow finishing third. So Mike, kind of from where we were sitting and everything you got to, if you got to rewatch race or whatever, what do you make of kind of a couple of days later of Will Power's comeback that day?
Yeah, one of his crew guys turned around and looked at us and said, it's bad. And I'm pretty sure I texted somebody that. And then all of a sudden, he went from almost a lap down to, okay, it's methodically working his way through the field. And then he finished third place. That's really an amazing drive by Will Power. One of his best drives of the year.
I am going to say I was a little frustrated with him for not pitting, not figuring out what was going on. Obviously, it all worked out in the end, but as it was playing out and he's like, no, I'm not coming in. What? So I thought that was a little bit frustrating, but I'm super glad that it did work out in the end and he did have a heck of a day.
Yeah, and, you know, good for him. I thought his perseverance and the willingness to not give up was excellent. Also, watching the race with Liz Power, who's Will's wife, was epic. She's actually, like I tweeted out, is probably one of my new all-time favorite humans. Just incredibly nice, and she's just a lot of fun to watch the race with. She's kind of a case of nerves at one point where she's just really nervous about everything, and then the other time she's just cracking jokes left and right. So it's really fun to be around her. And Will's comeback was excellent, so that was really cool. Next big incident that happened was the pretty vicious crash that happened to Spencer Pigot after a collision with Sebastian Bourdais. Looked like Pigot was trying to enter the pits, and I don't know if Bourdais just thought he was trying to block him. But basically, Bourdais got into the back of Pigot, and it substantially raised Bourdais' car off the ground. So it did get some air there, and Pigot crashed hard into the wall and then into the pit attenuator. Again, kind of a couple days removed from that. Jess, what did you make of that incident?
Yeah, I don't know what Bourdais was kind of thinking. That was just the front angle, obviously we don't have from the driver's seat, but from the front angle, Pigot was clearly getting over to go to the pits. Like, there was no car he was trying to make a move on. Like, why would he be in that random line over there? So I don't know what Bourdais was thinking, but it's a shame that he just ruined both of their days.
Yeah, the only thing I'm going to add there is somebody, I don't know if it was Bourdais or another driver or a Facebook comment, said that why didn't Piggott take a tighter line going out of that final corner? You kind of can't take a tight line there unless you want to lose all position on the track. So not sure what else Piggott was supposed to do there, and it's unfortunate that he, that it ended his race. Thankfully, he was okay because that was a pretty big hit. But yeah, definitely not good.
And as we had Pato O'Ward on in one of our episodes, he said one of the most frustrating things is when people can't take responsibility for what they did. And for me, when Bourdais, I think it was Racer who published it, or maybe it was just the IndyCar media site, or I can't remember where specifically it was published, but he was basically saying it was Piggott's fault. Like the nerve to blame Piggott in that situation where he's getting over, making it pretty clear that he's going to come to the pits. You run into the guy, you wreck him, put him in pretty serious danger and whatnot, because it's a pretty big hit. And then to come out and blame him after the race, I was disappointed, but not very surprised, unfortunately, because it's not Bourdais' first time where he just doesn't admit fault. So unfortunately, yeah, I think Bourdais got that one wrong. And yeah, I'm just glad everybody's okay though. And not the author Stephen King pointed out to us too, the tethers on Bourdais' front wing did a great job, because that wing was definitely going to fly off had it been last year, and that could have been put the drivers behind them in danger of flying debris and whatnot. So for those tethers to work, a great safety improvement and good job on IndyCar there. I'm glad everybody was okay in that crash. Jess, I know you touched on Tony Kanaan being kind of a goof there in the turn three, lap one incident. I don't know if you had anything else to add before I tossed it to Mike on the crash that Rosenquist, Power, Pato, Kanaan, and Laced, and Pagano. Sorry, a lot of going on there. I didn't know if you had anything else you wanted to throw out there before we tossed it over to Mike on that one.
Other than I would put the blame on Power. No, not really. I mean, Power started it, and obviously it just became in a melee right in the middle of everything. It was a shame.
Yep, I have nothing to add to this one.
Okay. It's kind of weird because in the press conference, Power said that it felt like I got hit from behind. It looked like when, we watched the replay again, I think the contact from behind came to after Power had hit Rosenquist. So the only thing I'll say is I was kind of bummed out of everybody in that crash. I mean, obviously the defending Indy 500 winner continues to get snake bitten at Detroit. Rosenquist recovered well. Pato, though, I felt bad for him because he got hit first lap of the first race and then to get hit again, but he did a really good job of recovering. One of the interesting I'll just keep it interesting just to keep it objective, is the Felix Rosenquist crash. He brushed a wall, and then three turns later into turn one, something had broken on the car, so he couldn't really steer it anymore, and he just slid around and smacked the wall. And there's some crazy rumors flying around about Rosenquist's job security based on some of these recent crashes he's been having. And Mike, I didn't know if you wanted to kind of take your thoughts on either the crash or the job security or Rosenquist as a whole. Like, should he be concerned about his seat?
No. The longer answer would be, I think he had a cut tire he had a broken suspension piece from brushing the wall of the lap before. So, it was definitely a couple of mistakes made by him this weekend, and that led up to that crash. But he's qualified well for the most part. Got the pole earlier this year. So, is it time to worry about his job security? No, I don't think so. He's a rookie. He's bound to make mistakes. We can't expect every rookie to win in the second race of the season like Colton Herta did. I think everybody needs to relax on that one a little bit.
Yeah, I'll agree with you. Not at all time to start worrying. I don't think that drivers should start worrying until it's, three or four races left is all. And then it's more because we're getting ready for silly season stuff, which is just normal. So do I think that crash right there is, the straw that broke the camel's back? Absolutely not. I definitely don't. I think he's safe for right now.
Yeah, I think it's a little absurd to be talking about him being fired after, well, A, all the preseason hype, B, he's had a couple of very good races so far, and, you know, people point out that he crashed at Circuit of the Americas. I pin that as a racing incident. Obviously, the crash in Indy, the first one was on him. The second one was, you know, there's an incident going on in front of him. So it's hard to pin that one on him. And then this Detroit one is on him as well, just like the Indy practice crash. So, and no, it's way too early to be talking about getting rid of him, especially if you can't get Rossi, then you might as well not even waste your time, because I don't know if you would be able to find a better candidate for that seat at the moment, based on what we've seen so far, and that he does have all that potential. So it's a little ridiculous. But real quick, so Jess, you said Kanaan as far as your disappointment of the day. If you want to stick with that, if you wanted to give us your driver of the day for race two.
Yeah, I'm going to go with Ferrucci. I know he didn't finish, I think it was 10th or something.
Yep.
Yeah, so he didn't have the greatest finish, but man, he drove a really good race. He got caught out, unfortunately, but I think that he had a good race, that he's showing improvement, you know, honestly, weekly at this point. I think he's really starting to feel comfortable in the car, and it's really fun to watch him. Man, he's, I don't know how to say it, PC, so he's very ballsy.
Surprisingly, I was going to go with Ferrucci as well, so I'm going to leave the obvious choice on the table for Matt here and go with Pato, who got hit in another lap one incident and was able to recover to 11th. I think at one point he was even a lap down, or at least for a, you know, a good chunk of the race he was a lap down.
I think he was two laps down.
Yeah, that's certainly possible. And to finish 11th is a very good indicator of you know, his talent. So good on him. My disappointment is Joseph Newgarden, just, you know, after qualifying on the pole, making an unforced error. Just, you know, you can't do things like that and win the championship in the long run.
Surprising enough, I was going to go with Pato, just because I thought you would go with Power. So I'll stick with Power. Unbelievable race. Great job by him to recover after all those things went wrong. It's a championship-worthy drive. I think the championship still might be a long reach at this point. Still a lot of season left, though, I guess. But good for him. Disappointment of the day. I mean, low-hanging fruit, I guess. I'll just go with Max Chilton. Didn't really do anything, I guess. I mean, he finished 15th because everybody behind him either crashed or had an incident. So still not seeing the pace and the progression that we need to see out of Chilton and Carlin. And we'll touch more on him and later on in the episode here. But yeah, didn't really do a whole lot for me this weekend, unfortunately. Before we move on to, and then kind of put Detroit in the rearview mirror here, Mike and I were there and it was awesome. Unfortunately, we missed Jess there. And Mike Knapp, the blogger, took the weekend off as well. But Mike Knapp will be in Texas, so wish him the best there. Mike, it was your first time in Detroit, right? I'm assuming.
Correct.
Yeah, it was my first time too. So overall, what were your thoughts about the Detroit experience and being there firsthand? And what did you make of the whole race weekend?
It's a, you know, really great experience for fans. There's a ton going on, plenty to, you know, food vendors, plenty of different places to get, you know, merch, whether it would be IMSA merch or IndyCar merch. Looked like there was some, you know, some sort of lawn bowling and cornhole type games going on. And obviously there were concerts throughout the day, both Saturday and Sunday. So just, I think, a really good family friendly race atmosphere. So props to everybody for, you know, putting on a great weekend in Belle Isle.
Yeah, a lot of things to do. Definitely a well taken care of area. Penske definitely has invested a lot of money in it, and you can really tell. As far as personally speaking, you know, getting to spend the weekend with Mike was really cool. Getting to interview Emerson Fittipaldi was surreal. Getting to watch the race with a lot of cool people like Mike, like Liz Power.
Yes, me.
Chris Fambro, who's on Team Penske Pits, we had on as a guest a while back. His girlfriend Holly was amazing. We had dinner with a guy named John. Fortunately, we don't have a social media or anything like that, but he was an awesome guy to talk to. Just so many good experiences to take away. And I think at the center of that was just Belle Isle itself was just a really good place. Media center was friendly and all that good stuff. So I really enjoyed it. And definitely going to look to come back next year for sure. With that, we could throw it to Patreon shout outs.
Yeah, let's see here. Thank you, Mr. Colin Taylor, Darcy Bretz, David Lighting. His quarterback's been in the news for some funny reasons lately. Our buddy George, Mr. Jake Neely. Thank you, Jason Camps, Carrie Chim, Lyndall McMurphy, Mark Van Niekerk, Matt Grunholds, Michael Goodyear, and Michelle.
Sweet. All right, Jess, go ahead and stump us.
All right, guys. So I've got Stump the Host this week, and of course, I'm going to make it Texas-related. So everything is quote-unquote bigger in Texas, right? I mean, that's just what it's about. Like, that's, you know, they're saying whatever. So I want to know, do you guys have a good guess on the total permanent seating at Texas Motor Speedway? How many people can they cram up in that place?
Oh, gosh. Is that including the back straight?
Okay, no. So this is the permanent seating. So, or you can do total capacity, whichever way you want to do it.
I'll say.
Because I got both numbers.
I'll say 175,000.
For which one?
Capacity.
Okay, Mike, stop Googling.
I'm not. I'm literally trying to come up with a number that makes sense. I'm gonna say 125,000 for total capacity.
Okay, so Mike, you're really close to permanent seating, and Matt, you're really close to total capacity. So total permanent seating is 128,655, and total capacity is 181,655. This is all coming from TexasMotorSpeedway.com. They actually have some really cool facts on here about the track. Like, I don't know if you guys know, and this would be good for me, not so much for you guys, but there's actually twice as many women's restrooms as men's restrooms. There is 1,656 women's restrooms there. That makes me happy.
Yeah, wow. Does it? So,
do Matt and I tie then?
Sure, yeah, because you both were really close to one or the other.
Oh, well, yay, we did things. All right, let's move on to Texas, speaking of Texas. Yes. Championship outlook, it looks like we got the following here. We got Newgardens in P1 heading into the race, followed by Rossi, Pagenaud, Dixon, Sato, Power, Hunter Ray, Hinch, Rahal, and Bourdais. Weather looks good. Last time I checked, I guess it could have changed. It probably will change about 17 times between now, which is today is a Wednesday, and the race day on Saturday night. It's kind of a weird thing going on with this year. Not that I can remember, because I've usually the Texas, they practice Friday afternoon, they qualify Friday as the night begins, and then they practice after qualifying. This year, though, they got a practice on Thursday night, replacing the Friday night practice. And Firestone, this is according to Steve Wittick on Twitter, Firestone is bringing two compounds to test Thursday night to kind of determine which one they want to use. And so before we get to our predictions, Mike, is that a good idea, question mark?
Yes, it's a great idea. You know, especially after maybe messing up the Detroit red tire issue, you know, being able to test a couple different oval tires before, you know, what's typically one of the hotter races of the year. I think it's a fine idea.
Yeah, I don't think it's a bad idea. I hope that the weather Thursday will be similar to the weather on Saturday night, because, I mean, obviously, if they take tires out and it's 110 on Thursday and it's 55 on Saturday night, that's going to do nothing for them. But hopefully the weather will be similar. I honestly have not looked at it at all. So, but yeah, I mean, I think it can't be a bad thing for sure.
Yeah. I guess I'd rather them get it right, question mark, but it's kind of a little nerve wracking. They're leaving it so close to the race and like, what happens if they both suck? Can be a bad situation, I guess, but we'll see. I'm sure Firestone did their homework and whatnot. So moving into predictions, Jess, who you got winning and who do you got as someone you mark as maybe someone who will struggle this weekend?
Oh, man. I'm going to go. So winning, I don't know if he's going to win or not. I think I have a good feeling. I have a good feeling about Connor Daly. I don't know if he's going to win or not, but I think he's going to do well. And then doing bad. I want to say, I hate to say it, but I think Bourdais, I think he's going to have another rough weekend. And I don't know why. It's just kind of one of those gut things. I just feel like, you know, maybe he's not going to bounce back very good from that accident in Detroit. So I feel like he might struggle a little bit.
So I'm going to start with my struggle pick first and go with, I'm going to go with Marcus Ericsson. I know he's been, you know, pretty impressive, obviously finishing second after starting 12th in the second race was very impressive, but Texas is a whole different beast, especially even compared to Indy with the the high banked ovals, and he might take it easy on this one and finish outside of the top 10. And who's going to do well? Let's see here. Hinchcliffe has had a couple good races here in the last few years, so my pick is going to be Hinchcliffe.
Wow, going with the teammates, I like it.
I didn't do that intentionally.
My prediction for the winner is the guy who should have won last year, which was Marco. No, I'm just kidding. That's actually just a low-key jab at Jake Neely, who is insisting that Marco would have won the race last year, and I keep calling him out and saying that it wouldn't have happened. But I'll go with his teammate, though. I'll go with Zach Veach. I think Zach had a pretty good race going for himself last year before he brushed the wall. If he can keep four wheels on it this year, I think. Well, I guess he technically did last year too, but if he can keep all the suspension intact, I guess we'll say, I think Veach can actually run really well there. I'm curious to see if Andretti carries their momentum from Texas last year into this year as well. As far as struggling, I am going to go with, can't pick Foyt, so who's next in line for that?
I mean, you can. It's just
It's just the easy way out. You know, I'll go with Carlin as a whole. I think Kimball and Daly. We didn't really get to see a whole lot of them at Indianapolis. I guess we're still not quite sure where they stack up on ovals. I mean, Kimball did pretty well for himself, but Kimball's also been really good at Indy in his entire career for the most part. So we don't quite know what to expect from them at a high speed oval, so I'll just stick with Carlin and curious to see if Kimball and Daly could elevate that team to being good at an oval. Fingers crossed they do, but I'm a little worried about Carlin heading into the weekend. Finally, just real quick, Mike, do you think we're going to be in for a good race?
Yes, I think this tire test will hopefully help them get ready for the weekend and at least pick a consensus good tire plus the, few extra aero options they have. And the fact it's not going to be 150 degrees during the day in Texas this year should help. All of those should definitely help.
I think it's going to be a good race. I mean, Texas always, I can't say always, but like 90% of the time, Texas produces a race that has me sitting on the edge of my seat for the majority of the evening, so I can't wait for it.
Yeah, it should be good. Turns 1 and 2 still worry me a little bit since they redid it. I really hope there is a second groove this year in turns 1 and 2, and if not, it makes things a little interesting, a little sketchy on restarts especially, but Texas is a good track, and I always appreciate when any cars go there, so that is a good time here. Mike, we saw a driver change this week, which kind of caught us out of left field so much. take us through that here.
Yeah, I'll take over here for the remainder of what we have, and we'll start with we've mentioned his name a couple times, Connor Daly, in for Carlin in number 59 Gallagher insurance car right now, just for Texas. The other three ovals have not been announced because Max Chilton has bowed out of the remaining ovals for 2019. Jess, any initial thoughts on what Chilton said or Connor Daly being in this weekend?
Yeah, I'm excited to see Connor get another shot. I hope that he does well with it. Obviously, I feel like he's going to, since he is my pick. As far as the Chilton piece goes, I personally am fine with him taking a step back if that's what he wants to do, if he thinks that's the best for him and for his family. Absolutely. I don't, I never was mad at Mike Conway when he stepped away from ovals, and I would never, I guess, judge somebody for that decision, because that's their safety, their life, and their career. So why would somebody, try to, I guess, dog on him for that?
Yeah. So as far as me, Daly is, it's kind of funny to see him. Well, it's not really funny, but he's basically turning into like the Roberto Moreno of the world, the super sub. Because he just keeps getting these random call-ups to teams, and then it's for usually a short period of time, and then that team doesn't really want him back the next season, which is really unfortunate. But hopefully he can make the most of this Carlin experience, and maybe if he does well enough, can leverage it to the final three races in that seat as well. And then as far as Chilton, the only thing I didn't like was, he put out a statement via Carlin, and people immediately started jumping to conclusions. He said it was part of a risk management, and just, can't remember the specific words he used, but I think it was just kind of risk management per se. And then he later, a couple of sentences later, talked about cockpit protection, and people assumed that because he had mentioned that as well, that it was about him not feeling safe or something. And I think we were trying to connect dots that may not have been there without knowing the full story. He could have been, basically after Indy, maybe he's just saying, maybe I'm not good at this as I need to be right now, so we maybe just need to try someone else. Or there's a whole slew of reasons that he could be stepping out. I don't think the first one that we should be jumping to is that he's quote-unquote scared or anything like that. So I don't know if I buy that per se. So good for Connor, and I'm glad Chilton is sticking around because I do like him. I just, unfortunately, the results just haven't been there for his IndyCar career.
Yeah, maybe Indy was a wake-up call in terms of maybe I should step back here and just kind of watch and learn, like some of the Connor Daly's have done as they've been at the track and on the pit box every weekend. So, good on Chilton and just saying, listen, we need this. This isn't best for the team right now. And, great for Connor Daly. Any seat time a guy like Connor Daly can get is good in terms of trying to find a full-time seat, especially after an impressive showing in Indy. So we'll continue on the Carlin racing train here. Mr. Pato Award, our buddy, is not doing Iowa or Gateway, but Carlin has said that both of their cars will still be in that race, obviously for leader circle money. I don't think this is the most surprising news. Actually, I'm pretty sure it came out somewhere a while ago, but it hit all the major websites and news organizations this weekend. So Matt, any initial thoughts, and who are your picks for replacements?
Yeah, not really surprising given the Red Bull affiliation, and I guess we can enjoy Pato while we have him because I don't know if he'll be back next year. But as far as who gets the seat, I'm trying to think off the top of my head. I don't know if Kimball can just, snap his fingers and make the money appear out of nowhere, because it seemed like he had a pretty defined plan before the season started. So I'm trying to think of who else it could be. Depending on funding, it probably needs to be a pay driver just because that car doesn't really look like it has a whole lot of sponsorships. So honestly, it'll probably be one of Jess's people. Perfect world, a guy like maybe like Sage Karam or Connor Daly, if someone happens to take the 59 car from Daly, if he somehow finds a way to get into Pat OC, that'd be pretty cool. Oriel Servia would be pretty cool, especially with what happened earlier on in the season. So I guess it could be anybody, really. It's probably going to be someone that we've probably never heard of before.
I have to agree. I have a feeling it's going to be somebody we've never heard of before. I hate to say this, but I kind of hope it's not Oriel after everything that's been going on, because neither one of them will let it go on social media, by the way. Oriel said something again, I think it was this morning, or yeah, I'm pretty sure it was this morning. Do I think Pato is all but gone for next year? Absolutely. I hate to say that, but yeah, I think I've said it before. I don't think he's coming back. And then who do I think will get that seat? Gosh, I don't know. Like you said, I feel like it's probably going to be somebody that none of us have ever heard of, but I guess somebody like a Tristan Vautier wouldn't, I mean, maybe he could throw the money together. I don't know what his schedule is. I'm just trying to think of people who do fairly well, who could possibly work it in with their schedule. And that's kind of the hard part, being as we are right in the middle of the season already. So I think it's going to be a scheduling and a money thing for, honestly, for both cars at this point.
Yeah, my gut says it's probably somebody like Oriel Servia. It'd be great if Karam had the money or has the money to bring it together. It'd be awesome to see him get some extra seat time outside of the 500 for the first time in a couple years. But I think it's going to be Oriel Servia. So,
yay. Yay, Jess. Yay.
Yeah,
Boo.
And to expound on what Jess said, yeah, I think especially with the Red Bull sponsorship or, you know, program, whatever you want to call it, he's probably going overseas after 2019, and we will all be very sad about that. But we will discuss that more, I'm sure, at some point in the future here. Moving on, everybody's favorite topic in the last 24 hours on social media is IndyCar safety. Around the 500 weekend, it might have been on Carb Day, IndyCar and Jay Fry announced the new cockpit protection aero screen in alliance with Red Bull Technologies starting in 2020. Obviously, the prototype isn't even out yet and hasn't been tested, but initial reactions, Jess.
No. I'm gonna be like you. No. I'm not a fan. I know a lot of people are fans. I liked the windscreen. I would like the windscreen by itself. I don't like the thing they've come up with, though, at all. I think it's gonna limit vision. I don't think it's gonna work well. I'm just not a fan of it. It's just not, I'm just not a fan. I mean, I like that it's going to protect them, so don't get me wrong on that part. I do want head protection, but I just am not a fan of this particular piece.
So just for kind of clarification, so what about the windscreen do you like more than what Red Bull and IndyCar announced?
So, okay, so I know this is like down the run a bit, but to me, it is the halo off of an F1 car with a screen around it. If the screen doesn't work on its own, it's not going to work with a halo behind it. That halo is, in my opinion, going to obstruct views, especially on ovals. I just don't think it's going to work the way they want it to. I think it would work fine, you know, strictly road and street courses, but I don't think for ovals it's going to. I think they're going to have to work something out where they maybe get rid of that kind of middle piece that the driver would need to look around, like if they could do like a just the bar around the top with the windscreen or something, but they need to work on it a little bit.
Yeah, that's fair. You know, the amount of testing that needs to go into it to make sure A, you know, all the little things check off the box, like, well, first of all, that it's reliable and actually works, but then the little things like drivers remaining cool enough in the cars and things like that, you know, all that needs to be tested. The one kind of positive thing that we got going for it, though, is I think Red Bull has been working on this for some time, because I know they tested it in a couple free practices, or maybe it was, I don't know how many specifically, but they did put it on someone's car, I think in 2017. And, but then like, not like 3 weeks later, FIA announced the Halo. But I don't think this was something that was just thrown together. And I don't think it's in any way related to what IndyCar has been working on with PPG and whoever else was helping them with the aero screen that was tested last season. So, I don't know. I guess I don't want them to rush to it. If it works and they can get it ready by 2020, then I'm all for it. But if it's not, if there's some blind spots that we're missing with it, then I think they need to address that before they just slap it on the car.
Yeah, I think the key thing in the article or the press release is the fact they said, you know, we will have a prototype by, I don't know, June or July, and we'll start testing it at some point after that, which to me is, yeah, we really want this in 2020, but again, we're not going to rush into anything. And props to Jay Fry and team for, you know, sticking with the, if we're going to do this, we're going to do it right. And I didn't really think about it until Jeff said it, but the middle bar and, you know, if there's a way to remove it specifically for the ovals, or, you know, maybe do it the aero screen altogether without that, is a fantastic point. And I don't always like to agree with Jess, but I think she wins this one. So last question on this before we move on, do you think, and we'll start with Matt on this one, there is any chance this indicates any sort of future Red Bull re-involvement in IndyCar, maybe some sponsorship again?
Maybe if I had to pick one side or the other, I'd probably say no. It is nice to see them working with IndyCar to develop driver safety, and with Red Bull coming in to sponsor Pato for, you know, kind of just Pato the driver, that's pretty cool too. However, I don't think we've seen that translate quite into, you know, sponsorship decals in the car. And I would love to see Red Bull back. I just unfortunately don't see this as kind of a segue for that.
No. So I used to work for Red Bull. In fact, I worked for Red Bull when they left IndyCar and went to F1, and the sentiment then, and I highly doubt it's changed because they're still owned by one person and it's the same person that owned them then, was absolutely not. Don't want to be involved with IndyCar. Just because it's called Red Bull Technologies, I don't think that, you know, it's any indication that Red Bull is coming back.
Well, I think this is the very rare time where the three of us all have the exact same opinion on this one. So we will leave it at that. Moving on, we'll wrap up here with some quick news and then a group pitfall. McLaren, always trying to find a way to stay in the news. Not going to be full-time in 2020, says Zach Brown. And Fernando Alonso says, I just want to do the Indy 500. So the other bit of news from McLaren is Zach Brown kind of shifted some blame to Carlin for the 500 failure. Jess, was he right or wrong in his assessment?
Totally out of line, in my opinion. I think he should have just basically kept his mouth shut and, you know, moved on, kind of just walk away from May like it never happened and not comment anymore on it. So I think he was completely out of line.
Yeah, what Jess said.
Yeah, it just, you know, sometimes you just have to take ownership of the fact and say, listen, we weren't ready. And to blame Carlin, just, yeah. Well, I'll leave it at what you guys said. Marcus Ericsson told his management team, I want to be in IndyCar for 2020 and beyond, which honestly surprised me a little bit, only because, you know, he was trying to angle for you know, to get a test in one of the F1 weekends that doesn't coincide with IndyCar for the remainder of this year. So I'm happy to hear that. You know, he's been a solid rookie so far. One interesting tidbit from the Robin Miller mailbag was that both of the Foyt drivers, why would they even want to come back with how bad the team is doing in 2020? And he kind of insinuated maybe Foyt as a team won't even come back. Do you guys think that Robin Miller's maybe just being a little dramatic here? We'll start with Jess.
I'm actually shocked by this, with as friendly as Robin is with AJ, that he would even write something that was, you know, remotely negative. But I can't say I disagree. The drivers, if I were them, I would be frustrated also. Do I see the team folding and running away? Not yet. As long as ABC is there, I don't see them happening. But who knows? I've seen stranger things in my many years being around the sport. So we'll see.
Yeah, if ABC left them, I think they'd be in some serious trouble, obviously. But with how they're doing now, I mean, ABC's been with them since 2006. And they've stuck through some pretty tough times with the team. So I don't think that is something that they need to worry about unless ABC has told them otherwise. And I think Miller was kind of just grasping at straws. I don't know if he actually knows. I think he was maybe just speculating a little bit. So I don't see them leaving until we maybe hear otherwise.
Yeah, it's a little dramatic. But I mean, if you are Mateus Lace and you have, you know, you're bringing some Brazilian sponsorship, which I thought he was, you know, maybe on the back end, and you're trying to advance your career, you're not, you know, you're on the wrong team, because no matter what Foyt does and who they hire, it seems like they just continue to be mediocre at best. So Harding Steinbrenner today, I think it was Marshall Pruitt, came out with an article that said that they're in a little bit of financial trouble still, that the team crew members are actually buying some equipment to, you know, continue to help them out. So it seems like all issues there aren't clear. I am sure with Colton Herta and George Steinbrenner at the helm, they will figure something out and continue on through the full 2019 season, you know, especially with how marketable Herta is. Wouldn't, you know, it would be a huge shock to me if something happened there. The one interesting topic I did want to discuss real quick here before we get to the group pitfall is both IndyCar and NASCAR are looking into hybrids, hybrid engine technology further. At first, I was kind of skeptical of this, and the more I think about it, the more I think it might be the way to go. Jess, any quick thoughts on this?
I mean, so racing was started, you know, over 100 years ago as a proving ground for vehicles, different parts of vehicles, just vehicles in general. So obviously, it's trending toward street vehicles becoming all hybrid or electric in the future because of the environmental benefits. So I can see it being a positive for racing to go that way also, because it would, you know, it would go back kind of to the proving ground where, you know, watch our hybrid race here. And then if you like what you see, then you can come buy it. So I can see it happening for sure.
Yeah. Racing is the ultimate proving ground for new technology. And we've kind of touched on the IndyCar side of it. So I guess the fact that NASCAR is looking into it is really eye-opening to me. Between that and them looking at Dallara to maybe make a kind of a base chassis for all the teams, it's, I don't know what NASCAR is trying to do right now. It's kind of weird, but IndyCar, you know, they've kind of been open to everything, and we've seen hybrids slowly creep into the racing world. Wouldn't be too shocking, but yeah, like we've touched on before, as long as the costs are down and the engines don't sound too pathetic, I don't know if anybody would be opposed to it.
Yeah, I mean, Jay Fry tweeted, I think it was yesterday, you know, the exact words that were our episode title with when Jess and I interviewed him a couple of weeks ago: fast, loud, authentic, and unapologetic. So if he's going to stick with that and hybrids are a part of that solution, by all means, I think it's a good fit and will bring some, you know, added profile and maybe a couple, maybe even two more engine manufacturers. The one funny thing to me, just kind of chuckling, thinking about it, is if IndyCar and NASCAR introduce hybrid engines and, you know, sports cars, one of the programs has hybrid engines. Somebody more educated in sports cars can tweet at us, maybe our buddy George, and give us some more info on that. But kind of then makes Formula E not as relevant to engine manufacturers anymore. Well, maybe. But moving on, we'll wrap it up with a quick group pitfall here. Since there wasn't too much negativity this week, we are going to go with the gift that keeps on giving to me in Williams. I'll read a couple lines from this article here, and then I'll get your guys' opinion before we wrap up. But one of their senior engineers pretty much said that at this point, before their summer upgrade, that they are getting everything out of the car they can, and it's the best car they can get. That's really embarrassing when the best car you can get is a 15th place finish by George Russell. Do I think this big upgrade is going to help them? Nothing has helped them this year, so no, I think they are a lost cause. I don't know if you guys have any thoughts on Williams and their best car in 2019.
Well, if that's the best they can do, they need to just quit the sport. I mean, but it's honestly embarrassing if that's the best they can do. I feel bad for their drivers because their drivers are pretty talented and they're out there just no chance every weekend. And it's been this way for the last 2.5 years now. So if that was someone working for me, I would fire them and just try someone else. Cause that is honestly a very poor attitude to have and to say like, oh, well, we're doing our best. Like, no, I don't really think you are. So yeah, I would fire that person and anybody else who had that same attitude.
I would normally agree with you, but I almost feel like that person was probably forced to say that. Because I can't honestly imagine that somebody working for them truly believes that. I have a feeling they're being fed lines that they're to feed to the media. And it's, yeah, like you said, it's just an embarrassment at this point.
We can't be surprised by anything they do. I mean, this guy's probably like their head whittler or something. So, I mean, it shouldn't be out of the realm that someone would come out and say that if they were worked for Williams, I guess. I mean, we just don't know.
True.
Yeah, nothing surprises me with them anymore after you miss all the test days in the preseason. I'm sure during the summer break, instead of working on the car, they'll all be sitting on the beach eating, you know, drinking beer, and then they go, oh yeah, we have to do more testing on this.
No, they have to whittle more.
Right, sorry. I got ahead of myself. anyway, thank you guys again for tuning in this week. We'll be back with a good Texas recap and any other news that pops up. Make sure you go back this week. We published the Emerson Fittipaldi audio and took out the tornado siren that went off for 3 minutes in the middle of it. And the Colton Herta and George Steinbrenner episode came out earlier this week as well. So make sure to check those out. Both were great interviews. And with that, Jess, feel free to go ahead and sign us off.
And guys, keep your lug nuts tight.